Welcome to Podcast 2 of The Way of Perfection, Sister Teresa of Avila's Hallmark Spiritual Teaching. This podcast is sponsored by CarmelStream.com, the face of the Carmelite Institute. Now here's your guide, Carmelite Sister Fran Horner.
Welcome back, students, as we continue our exploration of Teresa of Avila's wonderful text, The Way of Perfection. And welcome to all who are listening to the podcast or watching this video on Carmel Stream. Today's class will focus on chapters 4 through 7 of The Way of Perfection, which is the subject of charity. You'll remember from last week's introduction that there are three virtues that Teresa is spelling out for us in order to become contemplatives, to have contemplation at the base of our soul. And those virtues are charity, detachment, and humility. So for the next few classes, we're going to be looking at this virtue of charity to see what Teresa really meant by it and how it can apply to our lives, and also what connection it has to the will, which you remember we looked at last week, that the will is relevant to the virtue of charity. And what is the connection to John of the Cross's Dark Night, in particular the Dark Night of Faith? And we're not going to do all of that today. We're just going to look right today at what Teresa says specifically about charity. Thank you to so many of you who submitted your assignments, picking out some important phrases that you found in chapters 4 through 7. I know that some of you may not have yet submitted your assignment because we had that problem with the website, and I do apologize. I was distressed myself about it, but there was little we could do until the web host fixed the problem. So I know there will be some more assignments coming in, but the ones that I've looked at so far have really been quite profound in their understanding of what Teresa is trying to accomplish in this text on charity. I'll be sending everyone who submits an assignment some individual feedback that you'll be able to look at the Carmel Stream eClasses website. I also want to take a moment to assure you, because I've had this question, your assignments are seen only by me. Other students don't see your assignments, and the feedback that I will be giving you on the assignment will be only seen by you and not by other students. So please feel free to communicate whatever you might like and know that it's going to be held in a confidential way. Now, I want to just recap briefly what some of the selected phrases were that the students picked out in reading these chapters. Quite a number of you focused on that paragraph about love for others. Love for others, and that's paragraph 4.10. It has that wonderful rhetorical flourish of St. Teresa. Let's look at it together. It says, "Returning to the subject of our love for one another, it seems pointless to be recommending this love. For are there persons who can be so like brutes that they will not love each other, even though they must always deal with and be in the company of one another, and believe that God loves them and they him?" A number of you focused on that paragraph and on other similar paragraphs where Teresa is talking about our need to love one another. But think how remarkable what she's saying is. First of all, she's saying, I'm not going to be taking my time in these chapters 4 through 7 telling you to love one another. That is so radically different than most everyone else's take on the virtue of charity. As we're going to see, unlike so many others, she doesn't say charity is about complete self-dispossession. So that's the first thing I want to bring to your attention out of that paragraph 4.10. The second thing I want to bring to your attention is that she's being a little smart aleck. She's using rhetoric here to emphasize how important it is to love one another, because she's saying, do you think anybody would be such a brute as not to love the people they live with? I don't know what your experience is from families, but it seems to me that the people we get most annoyed with in our families, in our workplace, are the people we spend the most time with. So the people that we don't live with don't usually cause us so much trouble, or the people we don't keep company with. So she's being funny a little bit and saying, "Are you? If you do that, you're a brute, but we all do it." So she's both at the same time saying, this isn't my most important focus, and yet you need to do it, sisters, because she's writing to her sisters. And why isn't it her most important focus? For two reasons. One, she really feels, she trusts that anybody who is an heir of hers, a daughter of hers, a son of hers, any of you who are trying hard to live this virtuous life, would never intentionally manifest a lack of love. That's not the temptation of a person who's striving to be on the path to virtue and union with God. Instead, these chapters are primarily about something else. So that's the first point I want to make about the assignments and the kind of paragraphs that Pepin picked up. Some of the other things that students picked up were the role of confessors. Now, that was a real interesting topic to many of you, and those of you who are using the class discussion forum, there's been quite a bit of interchange on that too. I've loved all of the entries on the class discussion forum and had intended, in fact, to write something back to some of you over the weekend, but then the website went down. But I'll be contributing myself soon. But this role of confessors is something we'll have to come back to. Another topic that was picked out by students was the role of passion in love. And a number of you were disturbed by Teresa's saying, don't love with passion, because passion is just throws things off. But then there was a whole other set of you that noted that Teresa says, when your love is purified, you love with passion. So we're going to have to explore that conflict a little bit. And the last thing, the last two points really that were brought out was not having your love repaid, not loving in order to have love repaid, and learning how to love with no self-interest. And those two comments get closest to the fundamental central focus of these chapters 4 through 7. So let's move from those to where Teresa really sets out the main theme she wants us to learn about loving, and it has very practical implications. That theme is set forth in paragraph 4.5. Now, some people picked out this paragraph, but not the sections the parts of it that I think are the most key for our purposes. She says, it may seem, this is in paragraph 4.5, about halfway down, it may seem that having excessive love among ourselves could not be evil. But such excess carries with it so much evil and so many imperfections that I don't think anyone will believe this save the one who has been an eyewitness. Now, I'm going to pause there. She is saying my main focus here is excessive love. In the paragraph before, she's talking about we err either by defect of love, meaning we don't love one another enough, or by excess. So her main focus is loving too much. What could that possibly mean for a Christian? We're going to find out it's loving in without the purification of contemplative prayer, loving in a way that is excessive in terms of whether it's true love or not. But I want to orient you to that. All of these chapters are about the problem with excessive love, and she says it's a serious problem. I'm going to continue reading. The devil lays many snares here, for this excess, is hardly noticed by persons having consciences that deal only roughly with pleasing God. And the excess even seems to them virtuous. Now that's amazing, the excess seems virtuous. But those who are interested in perfection have a deep understanding of this excessive love, because little by little, it takes away the strength of will, takes away the strength of will to be totally occupied in loving God. So that paragraph summarizes the entire thesis that will be carried forward. It mentions will, and it mentions being totally occupied in loving God, which is theological love. So all those connections that we're going to be making over the next couple of weeks are embedded in that paragraph. So let's see if we can explore together what does this excessive love mean. Paragraph 6 of chapter 4, so 4.6, describes its symptoms, the symptoms, how you know if you're engaging in excessive love. First of all, she says, you fail to love equally all the others. Fail to love equally. That means you're loving one more than another. And she means to the extent you're trying to practice true love. Father Kieran Cavanaugh, in the commentary to this paragraph in the ICS study edition, clarifies we can't understand the word equally there to actually mean equal, but uniquely. He says each one, this is Teresa's meaning here, each one must be loved uniquely, meaning loved for who they are. And he points out that theological love does not obliterate the human personality. So we must be loved uniquely as we are. And if you don't do that, there's some problem of excessive love. The second symptom Teresa describes is feeling sorry for any affront to a friend. So if somebody happens to inadvertently step on the toe of your friend, the friend that you're trying to get to love you, that you're trying to please, you may raise a big ruckus even though it's not your toe. That's feeling sorry for any affront to a friend. The third symptom is desiring possessions, so to give the friend gifts. What she's really getting at there is the need to give gifts. And why do we need to give gifts? Have any of you ever pondered over whether gift giving in certain manifestations is actually an attempt to control the affections of the person to whom the gift is given, to get them to love back? That's what Teresa's trying to get at here. And finally, and a number of you picked this out, and I love the part where she says, looking for time to speak with a friend and tell her that you hold her dear and other trifling things, it's a little bit humorous, rather than talk about your love for God. So in a sycophantic way, constantly needing to tell the person how much you love them, how beautiful they are, how wonderful they are. Now this is not at all to be critical of romantic love in marriage. It's really talking about relational love, where there is a community of people involved, not necessarily a religious community, a work community, a family community. And if you feel compelled to constantly say to the person you love how dear you hold her, you're trying to somehow distinguish yourself from other people she may love and to distinguish her from other people you might love. So this is not an easy teaching Teresa's giving us. And what is the solution to excessive love? She tells us in paragraph 8 of chapter 4, but if the will should be inclined to one more than to another, and that's what's happening in excessive love, let us be careful not to allow ourselves to be dominated by that affection. Dominated. It doesn't mean don't have that affection, but don't be dominated by it. Let us not condescend, O daughters, to allow our wills to be slaves to anyone, save to the one who bought it with his blood. Quite a number of you picked out that phrase, to allow our wills to be slaves to anyone. Do you see, there's the word will. Again, this excessive love ties to how we exercise our will. And what Teresa is saying is when we're engaging it, we're actually a slave to another person. We are unfree. We are dominated by an affection. Even if the object of our affection is not trying to dominate us, our own need is driving that the slavery we have to the person. In paragraph 4.6, she helps us some more and says, these great friendships, she means the ones that are actually manifestations of excessive love, are seldom directed toward helping one love God more. And that's a point John of the Cross always makes. He always says, That's how you tell if you're living virtuously. Is this helping me love God more? And finally, in 4.7, she says that perhaps one of her most famously quoted statements, all must be friends, all must be loved, all must be held dear, and all must be helped. There's a mutuality in that. And I want to say the word all includes you, yourself. In other words, it just doesn't include all the others that I'm trying to love. Well, I'm also included. You're also included. The lover is included in that statement. And so has the rights of any of the people in the relationship. There's a kind of balance built in here. Now, here are some other more practical aspects. Those are, you know, more of the theory of excessive love. Here are some more practical aspects Teresa describes for avoiding excessive love. She says, do not repay love. Now, again, can you hear the radical nature of what she's teaching? Do not reciprocate love. She's not saying do not love, but if your love comes from a motivation of repaying or reciprocating, she's saying it's excessive love and it's not a virtue. We've moved to chapter 6 in paragraph 5. She says about purified souls, about souls who have learned how to love well, they leave it to His Majesty to repay those who love them, and they beg Him to do so. In this way, they remain free. That's going to be that word freedom and free, we're going to hear it throughout this way of perfection. For it seems to them that repaying the love is not their business. Just stop and think how many times any one of us in the course of our day or week are actually doing a kindness in repayment. We have someone over to the house because they had us over to the house. We give a gift because we've received a gift. We want to make sure that we don't do anything to chill the affection of the other person. Teresa says that's all unfree and all an example of excessive love. A second practical point is about what our motivation is. And Teresa says in paragraph 6 of chapter 6, now note well that when we desire love from some person, there is always a kind of seeking our own benefit or satisfaction. So that is called the first degree of love in one of the more famous books on love that was published in the last 6 years. The first degree of love, where we're loving because of what we need. And many of us get stuck in that place, or even if not stuck, keep going back to it over and over again. We express our love because we're seeking our own benefit. And it takes a real engagement with ourselves in prayer, and prayer helps us with this. Prayer is going to be the purifying force to really understand that, yes, this is what I'm doing. And Teresa says that's excessive love. Another practical advice is, when we talked before about do not repay love, do not expect or want to be repaid for love. And here's that wonderful paragraph 7 of chapter 6 that many of you picked out. She says of those who have learned how to love properly, they laugh at themselves because of the affliction they once suffered as to whether or not their love was repaid. Because once we receive the payment, we realize that all the pay is straw. So she's saying it's worthless. And once you come to see this, you can laugh at yourself for being so silly, for ever wanting love to be repaid. It's all air. This is a great phrase. It's all air and without substance, so that the wind carries it away. And then finally, in paragraph 7 of chapter 6, she sums all of that up. If you can get away from all of those things, what happens to your love? She talks a little bit about, well, it could be that people will say you only love God and you don't have any passion, because she's already cautioned us about passion. Not letting our emotions take over, right? But she says, if you can get these things pinned down, in paragraph 7 she says, those people, I say, yes, they do love, with a much greater and more genuine love, and with passion, and with a more beneficial love. In short, it is love. So what Teresa is doing here really is focusing on the difference between true love and self-motivated love. Self-motivated love that masquerades as love. And that's the kind of love that many of us end up living often without actually noting it. And if Teresa had only said to us, love one another, we might never get to the realization she's trying to bring us to. And so the passion we might feel for somebody that's actually directed towards solving our own needs, that's what she's telling to get us to get rid of. Then we can learn to love God, and then through God we will love others with passion. What Teresa is really seeking for her daughters and her heirs, her sons, all of us who have come after her, is freedom from ourselves. This whole set of chapters on charity is about becoming free from ourselves. So I interpret Teresa's understanding of the virtue of charity to relate not just, or not even primarily, to a person's disposition towards others. After all, if this had been her intention, if she was really worried primarily about how we are disposed within ourselves towards others, she could have used a far more traditional approach to charity and not emphasized the dangers of excessive love. She could have just talked about the importance of loving others. She could have talked about self-dispossession, but she didn't. I interpret the virtue of charity, as Teresa describes it, as relating mainly to one's disposition towards self, and I mean self-image. The disposition that brings us to charity, and then to theological love, is freedom from ourselves. And that involves our self-image. It's freedom from enslavement to our need for affection and affirmation. Excessive love is caused by our need for affection and affirmation, our enslavement, our enslaved need. Freedom from the opinions of others. So we don't repay love so that people will have a good opinion of us. She's saying, no, be free of the opinion of others. Be free of the opinion of friends, of those we hold dear, of those we consider important or hold in esteem, or that the world holds in esteem. None of that should motivate our action. Not if we're going to be our authentic self. These enslavements are the objects of excessive love, as Teresa's examples illustrate. One cares so much for the opinion of another that she makes it her mission to contrive the other's happiness. And that's a futile mission, to be sure. Now let's examine for a few minutes the connection between this virtue of charity and the will. Remember, the will is one of the three human faculties among intellect, memory, and will that we associate with Teresa's virtues, and also that John of the Cross has associated these faculties with his knights of faith, hope, and love. So we need to spend a little bit of time on how humility and the will come together. Charity and the will come together. I jumped ahead to humility, but we're not there yet. How charity and the will come together. Now, Teresa has already tied charity to the will in the first paragraph I quoted, way back at the beginning, 4.10. The last sentence, those who are interested in perfection have a deep understanding of this excessive love, because little by little it takes away the strength of will to be totally occupied in loving God. Now we can understand this reference to the strength of will and the operation of the will if we consider the character of excessive love through the terminology of power. Now positive power, power exists, first of all, let me say, in any relationship. Power and relationship are partners. And everyone has power, whether you own it or not. It's a question of how it's used, positively or negatively. Positive power, from a relational perspective, is consistent with care, while negative power is consistent with control. That means my will rules. So when I'm letting my will rule, I'm exerting negative power. I'm exerting control over someone or something. In each and every interaction we might have, we need to test our first movements. That's a paraphrase of John of the Cross. He's always calling us to look at our first movements. To see if my deepest motivation is to care, think charity, care, or control. Now, control expresses itself in a variety of ways. Exploitation, domination, coercion, and perhaps, subtlest of all, manipulation. Those are forms of negative power. And here I'm using as the source an author called Michael Crosby. He's written a wonderful book called The Paradox of Power, and I'll be posting that reference and maybe copy out just a few pages of it for you to see, and perhaps you'll want to investigate it or get it for yourself. It's a wonderful book. Now, a behavior may start out looking like an expression of care for someone or something. That's excessive love. It starts out looking like love, like an expression of care for someone or something. But underneath, it is not care at all. See, excessive love could be defined as control masquerading as care. Do you get that? Control masquerading as care. So it looks like I'm loving, but I'm actually loving or performing whatever thing I'm calling love. I'm doing that in order to manipulate or control the other person's response towards me. Care is used to justify manipulation for the sake of one's own self-image, one's own needs disguised as tending the needs of another. And all of this is really implicit in what Teresa is saying. This 16th century woman had marvelous psychological insights. A person tries to control the response or opinion of another. It is not charity, though, Teresa reminds us again and again, to love only in order to have love reciprocated. Teresa is absolutely clear on this. When a person so wants to be loved, so wants a friend, so wants to be admired, she might do what she perceives will win her these prizes, what will most please that other person, but not necessarily what is most coherent with her soul's core. Do you see? That's how she becomes inauthentic to herself. Then her excessive love not only makes her inauthentic to herself, it damages all her relationships, including the one that's the object of her excessive love. As Teresa says, our behaviors can seem like a virtue when what we hope to gain is the opinion of a good person or the affirmation of a recognized authority. So I'm just doing this in order for so-and-so, who we all recognize as so good, to think that I'm a good person. Or I'm doing it because she wants me to do it. But we're really looking for that affirmation by somebody that others recognize as a good person. But in fact, what's happening here is the affliction of excessive love is blocking a person's openness to what God wills and to the dynamic movement of the Holy Spirit that is calling the person to be herself or himself. This is why excessive love is fundamentally a defect of the will. It is a misuse of power to manipulate another's perception to serve my own need or desire, my own will. So Teresa was concerned about her daughters, her heirs, her sons, I'm not neglecting the men, we have some lovely men in the class, failing in charity. She was concerned about them failing in charity, not through loving too little, but through an inordinate need to boost their self-image through behaviors designed to win admiration. Our goal, Teresa tells us, is to be free of this affliction and to entrust our loved ones to God without feeling that we must tend their every need. It's ironic, but when we stop acting to manipulate the feelings and responses of others, we ourselves are freed from being manipulated. We are free to behave in conformity to our best, truest selves, free to follow God's will. That's where we'll stop for this week. Your assignment for 3 weeks from now, you'll see it on the syllabus, and please do not neglect to read the syllabus, which is posted in the introductory part of the course, is to write a reflection of any length from one paragraph to a paper on what you disagree with in chapters 6 and 7, or what you find particularly challenging or wrong. So I'm having you reread chapters 6 and 7, and I'd like you to write on what you find challenging or wrong, or that you disagree with in either one of those chapters. The assignment will be posted in the usual way. You'll be able to upload it or just type it into the computer. I also will probably post some excerpts from John of the Cross, because for our next class we're going to look at John of the Cross's Night of Faith and connect that to Teresa's praxis of humility. So I look forward to seeing your responses, and have a good 3 weeks. And actually, I think it's 4 weeks. I stand corrected. You have 4 weeks for this assignment, because we have to take a little break for the July 4 holiday. So you'll have an extra week in order to get this assignment done and before the next class is posted. So during that time, please be well, and I send my love in Carmel. Thank you very much.
Are you interested in hearing more about Carmelite spirituality? Visit carmelstream.com, carmelstream.com. Carmel Stream, the face of the Carmelite Institute.